Morning, everyone. Always enjoy being here and worshiping with you. So it is a treat for me to be here, and very nice to see you all again. I was very sad to hear about the news concerning Jim Brown's daughter. I know this name Brown gets everywhere. We have five of them in London, and they're all over the place. But I've known Jim and his wife up in Aberdeen for many years. He and his wife are long-standing members. He's a deacon there. And I know, although it's only a small church there, that they will comfort him and they will be with him. But do think of them in your prayers and remember their daughter. Very sad to hear about that. I know as a father, I would not like to lose my daughter like that. So I do think of him, and thankfully we've sung of the comfort and the support, the shelter that we have in Jesus, and I know he will receive that. Well, when there is so much sometimes that is sad, so much that is troubling around us, it's good to have something to celebrate. And my wife and I had some reason to celebrate this year because we had a wedding to go to. About a month ago, it was on the 14th of September, and it was our daughter's wedding. So our elder daughter's wedding, and you can appreciate how big that was for the family, not least the worries and the problems and all the relatives and the new people. However, it was a joyful occasion, and it took place in two parts. There was a wedding ceremony in a local church, and then after that there was the reception not too far away. And for the wedding in the church, the formal part, the formalities were done by the local vicar, whom I'd already met, and a very nice young, well, not so young gentleman. And he did the formalities, he took the vows and so on. But our daughter was very concerned that the family should be involved in the service, not just to be there. It's not enough just to be the father of the bride. You actually have to take part in the service. So watch out, mums and dads. When your daughter gets married, she decides what she wants for the wedding, and you are in trouble. You are in trouble. So anyway, she decided that she wanted the father and mother of her husband-to-be to be involved in the service, and of course my wife and I as well. And she decided that her mother-in-law would give a poem about love, that her father-in-law would read 1 Corinthians 13, which we've just had, that Faith, my wife, would do the closing prayer, and that I would give a short message. Okay. However, I was warned. I was warned that none of this Bible-thumping stuff. The people who'll be there in that church never go to church. They only go to church under sufferance because she's there and she's getting married and they're supporting her. If they're Christians at all, they're only very nominal Christians. So whatever I say must not offend them. Right? No pressure then. However, whether or not I succeeded, I leave you to judge, because I'm going to introduce my message today by sharing that short message with you to begin with. See what you think. So I started off by mentioning that there has been this film that was around recently in the last few months, and it was all about looking back. It was in the past. It was about memories or something like that. I can't remember the name now. My memory is appalling. But anyway, it was a look back to the Beatles. A very nostalgic look back to the Beatles. Yesterday. Thank you very much. I did that in the service as well. I couldn't remember the name. And someone prompted me from the service. So we're being authentic here. So you've probably heard of the film. It's not particularly great, but it's a remembering of the Beatles. And that's interesting because although they've been around a long time, it is a long time. It's over 50 years. And of course the Beatles had a number of love songs which got very popular, got very well known. But one of them was a bit unusual if we think of their love songs that they sang. One of them was the song of a young man who is contemplating marriage. Just as my son-in-law was about to commit himself at that point. And he looked forward to the future, many years ahead. And he thought, what's it going to be like when we get on in years? Not very well now when we're young and fit, but what happens when we get old and tired and weary and decrepit? Who is going to look after us? How will it work out? And you may have guessed, it was called When I'm 64. When I'm 64. He was worried about the future. Well, that's at least he was taking it seriously, which is a good thing. Just to share with you the last verse of the song, just to remind you, and this is meant to be funny. When I get older, losing my hair, many years from now, as a young man, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings? Bottle of wine? Give me your answer. Fill in a form. Mine forevermore. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? So that was the last verse of the song, and they still sometimes sing it these days. But you know, that was yesterday. That was a long time back. That was over 50 years ago, half a century. Can't be possible, can it? If you remember that coming out, you must be getting on a little bit. So I don't want any responses. That was in 1960-something. Since then, things have moved on, things have changed. Today, 64 is not so old as it once was. People look at 64 and it's not as old as it once was. Today, if you want to be thought of as old, or if you want to think of someone who's actually quite old, the age you want to think about is age 89. Why 89? That's an odd age to think about. Because that is the age of a man called Colin Thackeray. And Colin Thackeray was a man who this year, dressed in his scarlet Chelsea pensioner's uniform, took part in Britain's Got Talent and won the final. And he won it with the song, another love song, Love Changes Everything. Now, he was singing from a very different perspective. He wasn't looking forward to marriage. He was looking back after 66 years of married life. And not only that, his wife, Joan, had died 3 years before that. So it was a bit sad. And he was singing it quite emotionally as a tribute to her. And clearly he meant what he said. He was singing from experience. He took the words to heart. And I'm told there was not a dry eye in the audience when he sang it. For him, the words were true. The words were spoken from experience. But what about us when we hear this statement, love changes everything? Is just that just a romantic byline? Or is it really true? As a general statement, love changes everything. Well, maybe over a lifetime you could look back and say, yes, I agree. But what sort of things does love change then? What sort of things? Can we think of an example? Well, one thing, you probably can think of a number of examples where love changes things. One example I'd suggest is the simple one. Love brings out the best in people. Love brings out the best in people. It brings out the best of the giver and hopefully the best of the receiver. It prompts a good gift and a good reception from it. Somehow in the giver, loving, giving, caring makes that person a better person. It brings out the best in them. And that gift of kindness, of love, are bound to have some kind of positive effect on the recipient. It may be an immediate effect, hopefully, or it may take time. It may take persistent, ongoing patience, kindness, forgiveness, and so on, as we read about in 1 Corinthians. It may take a while. And that applies both in marriage and it applies in life to everyone in general. So what kind of effect can we expect? What kind of effect? What difference does love make? Well, I suggest one effect which you can look forward to is joy. Love causes joy. And the Bible agrees. It does agree. The wedding, if you're attending a wedding, that is an occasion for formality. Sober vows, sober promises, a big commitment in the front of witnesses, signing the register. It's all quite heavy and sober. But it is an occasion for celebration and for joy. And so joy is very much associated with love and this binding and this celebration, this time of love. But you know, also, not just in a wedding, but in the little things every day. Smile, a cheerful word, a word of encouragement, greeting, hi. Just the little things. Love is involved there, and joy is involved as well, in a small way. I know if my wife is having a bad day, if I see her looking tired, or worried, or disapproving, then I know I've got work to do. I've got work to do. And so hopefully I do my best to encourage, to come alongside and help out. And hopefully, as I said, love will bring joy. Love will improve things. And it won't be long before I see the joy. I see a warm smile, a pair of sparkling eyes, and I know we're on track. Love is working. So, will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Of course. But 64 is merely part of the way. 64 isn't it. Instead, why not wait till you're 89? And at age 89, look back on a long and happy, fulfilling marriage and say, hopefully with conviction, with experience, love really does change everything. And know how true that is. Now that was the message I gave in that church. We continued after that. But I want to use it today as a kind of intro to what I'm going to talk about. You'll realise, of course, that love is a big subject. And if I'm going to talk about this subject, I need to focus it down. I need to bring it down to a bite-size proportion. How does love bring out the best in people, for example? I'd like to talk specifically about the power of appreciation. The power of appreciation. And I want to stay with Colin Thackeray and stay with the military to begin with. Let's take a couple of well-known sayings. There's one saying that says, familiarity breeds contempt. Well, it's not that we actually experience contempt. It's just that if you see the same person day after day, and you're shoulder to shoulder, and you're working, you're living together and so on, it's not that you experience contempt. It's just that you don't always appreciate that person quite so much if they're always around, always there. And so that's how that saying works. But the opposite of that saying is also interesting. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. We're going away this weekend down to Paignton, and I had to put the cat into the cat home yesterday. And you know something? She wasn't there this morning. I looked around. I couldn't see the cat. She wasn't asking to be let out. She wasn't mewing to ask for her breakfast. And I thought, oh, I missed the cat. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. When she's there, she's a perfect nuisance and a pest. And we shout at her. No, we don't shout at her. But you see, if you have that effect with just the cat or the dog, you may also possibly have a similar effect with fellow human beings. It's interesting that we don't always appreciate people very much. People that we see every day or regularly. But we do notice, funnily enough, when they're not there. Something's missing, isn't it? Something's missing. Keeping with the military analogy, you may remember the military wives and Gareth Malone, 7 years ago it was, I think. And he had this reputation for forming choirs of groups of people at work. And he came to realise that there were all these wives in these camps, these military camps in Britain, who, you know, needed something to encourage them, to build them up. And music is a wonderful tonic. So he got them together, as you know. It was a wonderful TV programme. And he got them to sing. And he got them to sing, actually to compose a special song. It was called Wherever You Are. And it was recorded. I think it even went before a Royal Variety performance. Wherever you are. And that message was aired, it was sent out to the troops in Iraq, along with letters and so on. And it was a wonderful expression of the wives feeling that they missed their husbands and vice versa. They weren't there. They appreciated them. They were missing them. And it was a lovely expression of how they missed each other and how they appreciated them because they weren't there. And they were worried about them out there fighting in Iraq, not knowing what was going to happen next. And so it was a marvellous experience expressing that song wherever you are. It packs a lot of punch emotionally. The same was true for Colin Thackeray. Though he was away from his home and his wife many times during his military service. But then, of course, finally, when she died in 2016, he missed her because they had a very happy marriage. He was really broken up. And to help him, he went into the Chelsea home, the Chelsea hospital. And gradually, people encouraged him to keep singing because he had been singing a long time. And if you want to read about him, the Chelsea Hospital has its own website and they have a whole page devoted to Colin Thackeray. You can read his life story there. So when he sang that song, he sang it with feeling because he did miss his wife. He was quite broken up when she died. You know how sad, how ironic it is that we only really value people when they're not there anymore, when they either have passed away in death or are on their deathbed. That's when our sense of appreciation is at its sharpest. We miss them badly. And sadly, unfortunately, we have lost a number of people in the church this year and last year, and we miss them. Funerals are a time when we miss that person. We may not have been our husband or our wife or our brother or sister, but it's someone we've known, someone we've been close to, someone we appreciated. And we share with one another that appreciation for that person who's no longer there. But if you are the husband or the wife of the person who died, you're the one who gets hit most. You're the one who feels it most. I have a day by day, which written by Irene Wilson on the 2nd of October, called Filling the Vacuum of Loss. He said, "Till death us do part, has a hollow ring when one becomes bereaved." He talked about marriage, and then she went on to say, "The impact of the loss of a loved one is unique to the individual. But the feeling of emptiness is common to all. As Christians, we know that God has a special place in his heart for widows and widowers, and orphans, of course, as well. He is their advocate, providing and defending them. Psalm 68 calls God a father to the fatherless, a defender of widows. God instructs his people to care for the orphan and the widow. And James chapter 1 tells us that's important. But it's good to realize that God does fill our emptiness. He understands, he knows exactly how he feels, how we feel. He gives us hope in the darkest of days. And so there is the sadness, the irony, that as human beings, it's only when a person has gone that we really appreciate them. Should it be like that? Could we not learn to appreciate each other more whilst we're still alive, whilst we still have life? What about that? Wouldn't that make sense? Wouldn't that be worth it to be able to express that appreciation, that kindness, while the person is still alive? Well, it's all very well to say that, but how do you show appreciation? What does it look like? What does appreciation look like anyway? How do you express it? I'd like to just share with you a couple of examples this morning. The first example is that of Ruth. Ruth was, as you know, associated with Naomi. And we can read about her in the book of Ruth, which just comes right after Judges, if you'd like to turn there with me. You're probably familiar with the story, so I will run through the highlights fairly quickly. Let's just run to the introduction. Ruth chapter 1 and verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, and if you've read that book, you'll understand that it was a bit of a confusion. Not unlike the day in some way, the time of judges in some ways, a bit chaotic. There was a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. So she was widowed. Then they married Moabite women, one named Orpah, the other Ruth. After they'd lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died. We're not told how, but they both died. And they don't seem to have had any children from what we're told here. And so Naomi was left without her two sons and without her husband. So she was a double or triple widow. And her two daughter-in-laws were also widows. So they all had this one thing in common, the sad loss of their husbands. And then verse 6, when she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people in providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With the two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she'd been living and set out on the road to take them back to Judah. So as they went with her, as she left the borders of that land where they were, she spoke to her two daughter-in-laws and encouraged them to go back to their own country. And in verse 11, Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons to be your husbands? Return home. I'm too old to have another husband, even if I thought there was still hope. Even if I had a husband tonight and gave birth to sons, would you stay till they grew up? And so on. No, my daughters, it's more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone against me." Then they wept again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. And Naomi thought, no, this isn't working. So she said to her again, "Look, Ruth, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." She encouraged her for her own sake. But, verse 16, Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you." And these are famous, wonderful, inspiring words. He said, "Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will be buried. May the Lord deal with me ever so severely if anything but death separates you and me." That's quite a commitment to be with her mother-in-law and support her in her old age and her widowhood, to be there for her, to encourage her. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So they went on to Bethlehem. When they got there, they were recognized. People remembered who they were. Then in chapter 2, verse 1, Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing, called Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick the leftover grain behind in whose eyes I find favor." And you know the story. The law was that basically the poor of the land were allowed to glean in the fields, because that's the only way they could get any food, to glean in the fields after the harvest. And so Naomi said, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Interesting coincidence, isn't it? Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they called back. Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, "Whose young woman is that?" pointing at Ruth. And the foreman replied, "She is a Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi. She'd said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She went into the field and has worked steadily from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So Boaz said to Ruth, and he actually obviously went up to her and greeted her and said, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field. Don't go away from here. Stay here with my servant girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the girls. I've told the men not to touch you, and wherever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." So he was obviously concerned for her, and, you know, he wanted to support her, provide for her. At this, she bowed down her face to the ground. She exclaimed, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you noticed me, a foreigner?" And as you know, the Jews, the Israelites in particular, didn't have dealings with foreign people, what they regard as foreigners. They're almost untouchable. It was a valid question. Why are you interested in me? Verse 11, Boaz replied, I've been told all about what you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. How you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you didn't know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge. What you have just read is a sincere and genuine expression of appreciation for who she was and what she'd done, explaining why he was so impressed by her, why he wanted to look after her. He was appreciating her. He appreciated her character, and he wasn't afraid to say so to her face. Interesting words. Another lesson from Ruth that perhaps we haven't noticed before, how Boaz was appreciated, and how he expressed his appreciation for her. And she said in verse 13, may I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord. You've given me comfort, have spoken kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of even one of your servant girls. And so on. So she continued, Boaz looked after her and made sure she had enough. And so the chapter ends, and we carry on. Time passed, a few days went by, and in chapter 3, things begin to get interesting. We're getting into, dare I say, a love story? Love story. So, here we go. One day, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be provided for? Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you've been, a kinsman of ours? Tonight you'll be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash and perfume yourselves. Put on your best clothes. Go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you're there till he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He'll tell you what to do. Well, in today's society, that would be a very dodgy story. I can just see that on the front page of the papers. I can just see people's reputation being dragged through the mud, appeals to the High Court, invocations, injunctions, don't tell them about this, don't publicise this story. No, another person's reputation, and was Prince whatever involved in this? No, really serious, heavy stuff. But, thankfully, this was not the UK 2019. Thankfully, it goes on. So, verse 7. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking, and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet and lay down. In the middle of the night, something stirred the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. Who are you? He asked. I am your servant, Ruth, she said. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer. So this was the act of acknowledging that she was his kin. And he replied, the Lord bless you, my daughter. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. Still words of appreciation. Appreciating her. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor, which is what you'd expect a younger woman to do. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character. And he obviously was appreciative and impressed by that as well. We don't know why he was single. There's no mention that he was married. Perhaps he'd been spending all his years building up his business, looking for the right person, hoping to find that right one, that right person, who would have the kind of character that he would admire and want to share his life with. But no one had turned up until now. Until now. And he said, although it is true that I am near of kin, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to redeem, good, let him redeem. But if he's not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until morning. So she lay at his feet till morning, safely, but got up before anyone could be recognized, and he said, don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. So he was not only wise, he was discreet. He was discreet. This wasn't a cover-up. This was being sensible, being wise in the process. I won't read the end of the story. You know what it was like. And it's wonderful to have a good story like this. Wonderful to have this story. It's a bit like a fairy story in some ways. It begins with tragedy, hardship, poverty, but it has a happy ending. Cinderella meets her Prince Charming. He's a bit old in the tooth, getting on in years. Not quite the young person that you'd think. But Cinderella weds and lives happily ever after. And they have a child. And the child is the forefather of David. What a happy ending. What a success story. All because Ruth was faithful and loyal to her mother-in-law. And because she met her kinsman Boaz, who appreciated her and acted on that appreciation and supported her and showed that appreciation. Wonderful story. Wonderful story. And it's always good and encouraging to read it. I happen to see this. We see so much tragedy, so many things going wrong, especially in the book of Judges. So many people who did the wrong thing, messed things up. But here, when something works out and people are speaking to one another with respect, bless you, my son, my child, all this, it's encouraging to see that, isn't it? So now I'm going to look at a second example, a very different example, and this is Paul. In fact, we'll take several examples from Paul. Paul, of course, as you know, spent some years in prison, and while he was in prison, he wrote to a number of the churches. And of course, he was separated from them. He wasn't able to go and visit them, encourage them. And he felt this. He appreciated that he couldn't see them. And he wanted to write to them and encourage them. And at the same time, he expressed his appreciation for them. In particular, let's have a look at Philippians, the letter to the Philippians. This is our second example. A different kind of letter, different kind of appreciation, not just to one person this time, but to a whole church, to everyone in the church. Now, there are special mentions to certain individuals in Paul's letters, but notice how Paul is just showing appreciation to everyone. Chapter 1 and verse 3. Chapter 1 and verse 3. I thank my God every time I remember you. In all my prayers for all of you, I always pray with joy. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to do that? When you remember, church brethren, to pray with joy. Because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. That's an interesting word, partnership. You will find that in a lot of the modern translations. When you think of partnership, you might want to think of John Lewis. You probably know the John Lewis partnership. It's an unusual example of a company whose success is built, at least in part, on the fact that it's not a normal limited company which operates for profit and to pay its shareholders. Every employee is a partner in the company. Every employee is a partner. And so it is a partnership, a genuine legal partnership. You can go on their website and you can read all about it. And they will tell you the company's values. They will tell you, they have other legal documents that you can read all about the company, their partnership and so on. And it motivates the employees because they're part of the company. The success of the company lies in their hands. And they are a partner, an equal partner in that company. And Paul is saying to the church, you have been partners with me in the gospel right from the start. That is, first of all, very encouraging, but also very complimentary. You are a partner, an equal partner with Paul in the gospel. And as partners, I'm now saying we in the church, feel involved. We feel motivated. We're part of the gospel. We're partners. We're part of the enterprise. We want it to progress. We want it to proceed. He talked about advancing the gospel in verse 12. The gospel has to advance. And as partners in the gospel, we want it to go forward. But notice how Paul is encouraging them, complimenting them, by regarding them as equal partners. Now that's quite a compliment. Then going on, he says, being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. Verse 7, it is right for me to feel this way about all of you. This was his feelings. Since I have you in my heart. He was quite emotional about it, in a way. He was quite
concern for them. He thought of them. I have you in my heart. For whether I'm in chains or defending and confirming the gospel, all of you share in God's grace with me. How inclusive is that? Everyone in the church shares in God's grace with him. That's the reality. Paul was sharing with them. You know, that makes me think. Sharing in God's grace. A group, an organization, a communion of grace, an international communion of grace. Have we heard that before somewhere? Grace, communion, international. Sorry. I couldn't resist mentioning that. But the point is, he was saying, you are with me. You share in God's grace with me. God can testify. God knows how I long for all of you with the affection of Christ Jesus. And this is my prayer, that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and depth of insight, so that you may be able to discern what's best, may be pure and blameless until the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God. So he wanted to encourage them, and he was complimenting them, and he was showing them appreciation. I mean, he couldn't really have praised them more highly than if he wanted to. But notice, he wasn't picking out one, he was picking out everyone, saying, you're together, we work together, we're in harmony, we share this together. So there was a different kind of appreciation here. A wonderful example of loving support to help them and to bring out the best in them. But he also went on to encourage them to appreciate one another. If he was showing them appreciation, could they not show each other appreciation? Chapter 2 and verse 1. Chapter 2 and verse 1. If you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any fellowship with the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, well, those are rhetorical questions. Of course they had. Of course they had encouragement from being united with Christ. Of course they had comfort from his love. Of course they had fellowship with the Spirit. And hopefully they had tenderness and compassion because of that. Then in verse 2, make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and purpose. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Consider others better than yourselves. I don't know about you, but I think humanly there's a tendency to read over that and think, too difficult. How can I regard people as better than me? Oh, that's too much. Can't do that. And that's what he says. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Summing it up, he's encouraging them to appreciate one another. To appreciate one another. And he also mentions, takes a similar line in another letter to another church. To the Romans this time. Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12. It's a long book, as you know. But just let me take one or two verses from Romans chapter 12 and verse 9, where he's making a similar point. Romans 12 and verse 9. Love must be sincere, must be genuine. Hate what is evil, cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Devoted to one another. Honor one another above yourselves. Honor one another above yourselves. You can only do that if you appreciate and show that appreciation. Keep your spiritual fervor, serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with God's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. And so there is that theme coming out in what he wrote to the Romans. He's not talking about flattery. He's talking about genuine appreciation. Learning to see things that are good in people, things that you like, things that where they are really doing well, to encourage them. Or it can also be to come alongside them. You appreciate they're going through a hard time, they're going through a difficult trial, and that needs support. And you appreciate that they're having a hard time, and you are there to support them and to help them in that hard time as well. So we have a shared calling, as Paul said. Let me just go back to it, read the words again. There's nothing like taking the actual words. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 7 said, all of you share in God's grace with me. We all share in God's. That's a tremendous statement of appreciation and of valuing everyone. We all share in God's grace. We all share. I wonder, do we really appreciate our calling as Christians? Do we appreciate what a blessing it is to be part of a church, to be in a church, to have the freedom and the opportunity not just to come to church, not just to be there, like going to a place and spending time there, but to be part of a body, part of an organization, part of a collection of people, of many brethren. Let me turn to another letter still, to the church in Corinth this time, in 1 Corinthians. And he had a similar message there. Similar message, but a different way. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, starting in verse 4. He's talking about spiritual gifts. But the main point I want to make is that we all have a part to play. And we can all appreciate one another. And he says in verse 4, there are different kinds of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are different kinds of service, but the same Lord. There are different kinds of working, but the same God works all of them in all men. Now to each one in the church, the manifestation of the Spirit is given for the common good, for the benefit of everyone. Not just for your personal benefit, for the benefit of everyone. To each one. Not necessarily the same, and he talks about different gifts. Verse 12, the body is a unit. Though it is made up of many parts, and though all its parts are many, many throughout the church, many in different churches, they form one body. So it is with Christ. We were all baptized by one Spirit into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, slave or free. We were all given the one Spirit to drink. So there is unity in the Spirit. However, verse 14, we understand that the body is not one. It's not made up of one part, but many parts in the body. If a foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I don't belong to the body, that's ridiculous. It would not for that reason cease to be part of the body. If the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I don't belong to the body, that's ridiculous. It would not cease to be part of the body just for that. If the whole body was an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? But in fact, God has arranged the parts of the body. God has arranged the parts in the body, every one of them, just as he wanted them to be. Didn't happen by accident. God's arranged it. If they were all one part, all identical, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, but one body. One body, many parts. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. The head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. We are all needed. No matter what part you play, we all have a part to play, and we are all needed. And that's an expression of truth. It's also an expression of appreciation. And realizing that we're all needed and we all have a part to play helps us, I suggest, to appreciate one another more. Because this is in the Bible. We all have a part to play. Verse 22, on that contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. Parts we think are less honourable, we treat with special honour. We don't look down on anyone, whether in or out of the church. We don't look down on anyone. We look, in fact, on the other hand, with special honour. Parts that may be unpresentable in some ways are treated with special modesty, while our presentable parts don't need that kind of special treatment. But God has combined the members of the body and given greater honour to the parts that lacked it, so that there should be no division in the body, but that its parts should have equal concern for each other. Equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. This is the church, the body of Christ. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it. good news. I don't know if you've ever been to Life Club, meeting of Life Club, but one of the parts of business in Life Club is to celebrate achievement. And they have an achievement award for someone who's done well or achieved something special in that year. And that's just a small example of celebrating something special that's happened. And then he goes on to say, now you are the body of Christ. That's a compliment. That is a compliment. You are collectively the body of Christ. And each one of you is a part of it. Each one of you is a part of the body of Christ. That's an expression of appreciation. Appreciation helping us to realize how much we count, helping us to bring out the best in us. And you know what he says after that? He goes on to chapter 13. And in chapter 13, he says, and I think there is a connection somewhere here, in verse 4, love is patient. Love is kind. It doesn't envy. This is the NIV. It doesn't boast. It's not proud. It's not rude. It's not self-seeking. It's not easily angered. Keeps no record of wrong. Love doesn't delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. No one said it's easy making a difference. No one said it's easy. It can be tough, it can be difficult at times. It can be difficult. It is outgoing, it is caring, it is merciful, it's patient, it's humble, and kind. But we have to remember that though it may sometimes seem pretty difficult, pretty tough, we're building muscles. Ever heard of muscular love? That's something to think about it. Well, this is muscular love. You're reading first there, 1 Corinthians 30. That's muscular love. It's also godly love. It's godly love. We love others not because we're good at it, but because God first loved us. And we began to realize what love is all about, what real love is all about. Because we realize how much God loved us. 1 John chapter 4. Key verse, only verse 19. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 19. We love, and some versions say we love him, because he first loved us. As he first loved us. And so we respond. We love him because he first loved us. And that love in loving God doesn't stay there. The way we express that is not just in our appreciation to God, and we do express that appreciation in worshipping him as we've done today, in loving him in return and expressing how much we appreciate him in our worship, in our thanksgiving, but that's not all. He says, if anyone says I love God yet hates his brother, he's a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother whom he's seen cannot love God whom he has seen. He has given us this command, whoever loves God must also love his brother. So it's nice and good and right to love God and to appreciate him. But we also have to love and appreciate one another. One of the gifts that God gives us is something we don't always recognize. It's a four-letter word, spelled T-I-M-E. Time, then, is a gift. None of us knows how much time we have left as human beings. We don't know. Sounds a bit morbid, doesn't it? But it is a salutary truth. None of us knows how much time we've got left. This is not a threat. It's just a reality. And with that appreciation that we do not know how much time we have left, would it not be good to make the most of the time that we have? Would it be not good to practice appreciation in church, especially where people are all of the same mind, but not just in church, out there on the street too? Keep it up, not just in church, but at home and in the neighborhood. Because someone once said, love changes everything. God's love in particular changes everything. I have for you the middle verse of the song. It says, love changes everything. Days are longer. Words mean more. Love changes everything. Pain is deeper than before. Yep, not easy sometimes. Love will turn your world around, and that world will last forever. Yes, love changes everything. Brings you glory, brings you shame. Nothing in the world will ever be the same. Colin Thackeray knew that was true from his experience, from his marriage. He knew it was true. He experienced it. And with God and with Jesus in our lives, we can experience it and we can practice it too.